Welcome to our program, The Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel-Palestine. This program is presented by Citizens for Justice in the Middle East, a Greater Kansas City peace and justice group advocating for a just and even-handed U.S. foreign policy in Israel-Palestine. Once a month, on the first Thursday of the month, at 7 p.m., this show will focus on aspects of the situation in Israel and Palestine. You can find podcasts of previous shows on our website, cjme.org. In today's program, we hear two different accounts about the domination of Palestinians by the Israeli government. First, Dr. Virginia Tilley relates the findings of a United Nations study she prepared with Dr. Richard Falk, which concluded that Israel is an apartheid state. The study provoked an impassioned controversy when it was published in March 2017 and was subsequently removed from the UN website after just a few days. In our second interview, we hear from Allison Weir, an American activist and journalist who has spent the past 18 years documenting the conflict in Israel-Palestine. In this interview, Ms. Weir will offer her observations of the day-to-day subjugation of Palestinians living in the occupied territories. Now we turn to our interview with Dr. Tilley. Currently a professor at the University of Southern Illinois, Carbondale, Dr. Tilley lived in South Africa for several years, where she conducted studies of South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy. She has published or co-authored numerous policy briefs on post-apartheid South Africa, and is author of two books on how peace can best be achieved in Israel and Palestine. Dr. Tilley, welcome to KKFI and our program, The Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel-Palestine. I would like to begin by asking you to help us understand how the UN report came to be, which entity within the UN requested the study, and how did you and Richard Falk go about fulfilling that request?
Well, this came out of the United Nations Commission called the Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, which includes all the countries in the Middle East except Israel. And they had needed a report on this because it's become a controversy in the United Nations. Richard Falk was the special rapporteur for the United Nations Human Rights Council on the question of Palestine. That's the way they phrase it in the UN, the question of Palestine. And I had just finished a report for the South African government on whether Israel was practicing apartheid in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So we were both tapped to do this report, and it was really quite an extraordinary experience to work with Dr. Falk on putting all of this together.
I know that in the report you have a definition of apartheid, and could you let us know what that definition, the definition you used in your study?
Of course, the question of apartheid is immediately sensitive. People use apartheid in all kinds of ways, including what happened in South Africa, which is, of course, the first case of this and the inspirational case for law against it. But we needed to be very careful here because we were dealing with the United Nations Commission, and we're both scholars, and Richard is an international legal scholar. So this drew us immediately to assume that we needed to use the international law on apartheid. And that appears in two places. One is an international convention, which is an agreement, a big international treaty, called the Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, which was passed back in the 1970s, and which defines apartheid and gives examples of crimes of apartheid, the kinds of practices that would be considered apartheid. And the other one was the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which is the body of laws that guide the criminal court's jurisdiction and case law, which lists apartheid as a crime against humanity in a much shorter definition. So the convention, the International Convention on Apartheid, was the main source.
And I know in the report, as you're exploring the question of apartheid, that you talk about four different domains of the Palestinian population and say how apartheid is implemented by the Israeli government in each one of these domains. In different ways. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. This was really the core finding of the report. Your listeners might know that one of the controversies about whether Israel is practicing apartheid is that Palestinian citizens of Israel have the right to vote in Israeli elections. And, of course, that's true. And they also have a certain body of equal civil rights with Jewish citizens. And so we were charged with looking at Israeli practices regarding apartheid anywhere. So we needed to take that into account. But what we found when we looked closely at the system is that Israel has fragmented the entire Palestinian issue into four separate areas, which are geographic areas that are administered differently according to different laws. One of them is inside Israel, where Palestinians do have the right to vote, but they are prohibited from forming any political party that calls for Israel not to be a Jewish state. And there's a whole host of laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens on the basis of the special status of Israel as a Jewish national state. So this really constrains Palestinians in their vote. They can vote for things like a better road in front of their school, but they can't vote to get rid of these discriminatory laws. And they also can't, a lot of these laws are designed to keep that population from growing beyond 20% of the Israeli population, because as long as they're that small, they can't ever get the leverage in the Knesset, in the parliament, to change those laws. And then the other areas, the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza, and different status that Palestinians have in the city of Jerusalem, and, of course, the refugees, there's millions of Palestinian refugees. Israel has special sets of laws for each of those categories. In the occupied territories, it's military law. In Jerusalem, Palestinians hold the equivalent of foreign residency, just like any foreigner might have, which can be retracted, and they don't have the right to vote in Israeli laws. Of course, Palestinians in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza also don't have the right to vote in Israel because they're not citizens. And then the simple expedient of not allowing those millions of Palestinian refugees to return to their country keeps them from having any say or potential say in Israeli politics. These four categories have long been recognized in Israeli policy, but they've also what hasn't been realized or understood clearly is that it's precisely through this fragmentation that Israel has sustained itself as a Jewish state, and that it so this oppression of Palestinians, of denying them rights, of denying them citizenship, of denying them security, is all one coherent, integrated system in which laws in each section work in complement with laws in all the other sections to protect Israel as a Jewish state. I realize as I'm saying Jewish state that a lot of people are saying, well, what's wrong with that? And, you know, there's, of course, a lot of sympathy for Jewish statehood. But you really can't have a territorial state for anybody without having discrimination for everybody who doesn't belong to the dominant group. And in this case, that tension has led to a great deal of human suffering and a whole series of wars. And it's really very much like apartheid in South Africa in that respect. So apartheid in South Africa also fragmented its laws in some respects. It had special laws for blacks in the Bantustans and in the townships and so forth. But in Israel, this is a different system, and it's really worked quite well both to disempower the Palestinian, indigenous Palestinian Arab population, and to kind of cover it up and confuse people about exactly how the system works. So that was the main finding of the report. I think it was the most important contribution of the report to our understanding what's going on in this conflict.
Okay, well, to focus just for a moment on the Palestinians who live within the state of Israel, not in the Palestinian territories for a moment, I wonder if you could clear up a couple of things. One is, I think most people are confused about the concept of citizenship and nationality, where non-Jews can have citizenship, but they are not entitled to nationality. And along with that distinction comes all kinds of discrimination.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that, because it's something that's very important in Israeli law. In fact, it was just reinforced with a special basic law. Israel has no constitution. It has a set of what is called basic laws, which comprise a kind of constitutional system. And they just reinforced that quite directly and openly with what's called the nation-state law, saying that Israel is the state of the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, and no other nation. So what does that mean? Well, Israel has always done this. What they have done is say that Israel is the state of the Jewish people. You can have Israeli citizenship, but that doesn't make you a member of the Jewish people. And under Israeli law, there is no Israeli nation. There is no Israeli people. So, in fact, the Supreme Court has explicitly said this, that there is no national identity that's recognized in Israeli law that would be considered Israeli. And that's very different from the United States and any Western European country, and indeed most countries of the world. If you have citizenship in all countries of the world, as far as I know, you are a member of the nation. In Israel, it's split. Citizenship and nationality are split. And then there's a body of laws that are designed expressly for the Jewish national community, the Jews who are understood to pertain to this nation and have special privileges to land, to educational subsidies. Jewish towns have access to funding that Arab towns don't have access to. And all of this discrimination is worked through separate agencies and separate body of laws that are designed openly and expressly to serve the Jewish people. So this is an oddity in the world, that there's a difference between nationality and citizenship. Palestinian Arabs and anybody who is not Jewish are therefore kind of cast into this nationless citizenship in which they have civil rights of many kinds, but state is not their state. It is not expressing their right to self-determination. And they are systematically discriminated against through this mechanism. This has been known for a long time, but it's being freshly expressed and appreciated now with the nation-state law that Israel just passed, which says this directly. It says that Israel is the state of the Jewish people and no other people. Jewish people have the right to self-determination, and nobody else does. And this is what the state is for. So I think it would be equivalent in the United States, say, if you found that suddenly this United States was being said to be the state of the Catholic people or the Germanic people and no other people, and everyone else can still run around and have rights and even vote, but they're not going to be able to change those laws, and they're not going to ever have the standing of the preferred group.
Okay.
So that's been an old problem within Israel. What we now found is how that fits into an apartheid system.
Okay, I want to remind our audience, I'm Jamie, and I'm speaking with Virginia Tilley, who is talking about her role in the UN report addressing the question of apartheid in Israel. And this is Understanding Israel and Palestine. I wonder if you could talk about the reaction to your report after it was published. It's my understanding that the response was immediate and mostly negative. Could you comment on that?
Oh, yes, goodness. It was really quite dramatic. What kind of the inside story is that the report was issued in a press conference that was based in Europe, and Dr. Falk and I were participating by Skype, I believe. And within 24 hours, Ambassador Nikki Haley of the United States, Ambassador to the United Nations, and the Israeli Ambassador to the United Nations, with pairing embassy, the Secretary General of the United Nations, really, you know, in a shouting bloody murder, and they insisted that it be withdrawn and rejected and denounced. And the Secretary General was really in a spot because he had, this was very unusual in the United Nations. He capitulated and agreed to do this. He ordered, he couldn't reject the report. He has no authority to do something like that, but he could pull it off the UN website. And he ordered the commission that had, Economic and Social Commission of West Asia chair, Madame Rina Khalaf, to do that. And she refused. And she resigned instead. And it was a dramatic event that hit all the international press. And the Secretary General then pulled the report from the website. I was expecting a great deal of attack. I think Richard and I were both expecting that because of the controversy of the issue. Most of it hit Richard, who is one of the most principled people I've ever met. I mean, he's a very courageous senior commentator on international law in all kinds of areas all over the world. He's also working on climate change and issues of the environment. And he's just really well known for his frank criticism of everybody, including Israel. So I was much more unknown, and I think they went after Richard because they knew how to attack him. I would add, though, that we never got any criticism of the report. The report itself was, I never had one single protest about anything in the report, that we got wrong, that there was a footnote wrong. There was nothing that was ever criticized. Actually, I do believe there was one footnote someone said we'd mumbled on some page or other. But there was nothing about Israel raised no objections to the substance of the report. All of the attacks were ad hominem. All of them were personal. Accusing Richard of anti-Semitism and me of anti-Semitism. And it was very painful for Richard, I believe. He's Jewish. He's a longtime human rights campaigner. And it, I think it was quite painful for him to go through that. But he's been through it before, and he stood up well to the whole thing, I think.
I was reading another book called We Will Not Be Silenced. It's a book about the academic repression of Israel's critics. And Dr. Falk wrote a preface to that book where he talked about all of the ways in which he has suffered as an advocate for justice. Then he has been excluded from talking on some college campuses because of the blowback from the report. So I know he does feel like that was pretty painful. But let me ask you about one final thing. Your report to the UN endorsed the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is the global nonviolent grassroots movement created to pressure Israel to recognize the human rights of Palestinians. Why do some academics now support the BDS movement?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, when we saw this kind of behavior in South Africa, where it was a little easier to spot because of the white-black difference, the whole world got on board. It was, and the boycott against South Africa became pretty much universal, and it was a comprehensive sealing off of South Africa for many access to normal life on the international stage, and It combined with the domestic campaign in very important ways to bring the regime to negotiate. Some people have said that the boycott program in South Africa wasn't so important, but I did spend 6 years there, and I talked to people on that, about that question specifically, and all of them said it was very important and that it had a great role in bringing the apartheid regime to its knees and forcing it to negotiate with the black, with the African National Congress, the ANC. So this, the boycott of Israel is following in, exactly in that tradition. People are inspired by observing that there seems to be a systematic program and regime of discrimination going on, and all of the reasons that are given for that, that the Palestinians are, you know, terrorists or whatever, is just failing. to explain the crushing of millions of people behind a wall and under military occupation. Their rights are not really extreme violations of their human rights. And it seems to be based entirely on ethnicity. If you're Jewish, you're fine and welcome. If you're not Jewish, you're under military rule. You know, I mean, it's really quite stark. And this has inspired people to launch do a boycott of Israel for decades. Now that really got started back in 2005 with a academic boycott and a new whole. What's now called the BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign, very exactly in the tradition of the South African experience and on the same basis, that this is human rights violations and that the state should not be treated as a normal state until it stops doing them.
Well, let me just say that, you know, it took the world a while to embrace the moral duty to shut down apartheid in South Africa. And so I know in your report you exhort us all for our moral and political duty to use any instruments at our disposal to combat apartheid in Israel. I wonder if you could make a comment about that.
Well, sure. I think we all know what that's about. I mean, we're all part of a global community. Everything that happens to any of us anywhere in the world ripples around to us eventually. And the individual responsibilities of everybody to be involved with that are clear. We need to consider that if people can be racially discriminatory in any part of the world, then they can be discriminatory where we are, too. I mean, if we stand by and let discrimination proceed in one part of the world, we are saying that it can happen here.
Right.
And we all have an obligation to each other and to protect each other, and on an organizational level and an individual level. So I think that's the basis of being behind any boycott program, and I would hope that people take a look at the report and educate themselves on what's going on and consider their own role in reinforcing human rights globally for all of our sakes.
And that report, by the way, is going to be posted on the website cjme.org, which is Citizens for Justice in the Middle East. That's the website. And Citizens for Justice in the Middle East is sponsoring this program, Understanding Israel-Palestine. So we've been talking with Dr. Virginia Tilley. Thank you again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're tuned in to 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City. This is the Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel-Palestine. You've been listening to Jamie Jackson interview Dr. Virginia Tilley. I'm Jeremy Roth-Gushel, and these are the news headlines. 972mag.com reports from November 5, 2019. On November 4th, Israel's Supreme Court upheld the deportation of the Israel and Palestine Director of Human Rights Watch, Omar Shakir, after a lengthy legal battle to allow him to remain in the country. Shakir says he will now have 20 days to leave or face deportation. Justices Neil Hendel, Noam Solberg, and Yael Wilner accepted the state's claim that Shakir, a U.S. citizen, supports the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, movement, rejecting Shakir and Human Rights Watch's appeal against his expulsion. Shakir's case has been described as a watershed moment for free speech and human rights advocacy in Israel. The ruling is based on the 2017 Amendment to the Prevention of Entry into Israel Law, which authorizes the Interior Minister to withhold temporary visas or residency to any non-Israeli citizen who has publicly called for or pledged to participate in a boycott of Israel. In August, Israel relied on the same law to prevent Congresswomen Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib from entering the country. The International Solidarity Movement at palsolidarity.org and the UK Independent are reporting from late October 2019 that a British forensics team claims that new evidence shows Israeli soldiers live fire shot a Palestinian boy in the head. 9-year-old Abid El Rahman Yasir Shatawi was shot in the head in July while sitting outside his friend's house during a protest in the West Bank village of Kafir Kadum. He sustained severe brain damage and remains hospitalized more than 3 months after the attack. Since then, Abid's parents have been left in the dark as to why their son, who was not even participating in the protest, was shot by Israeli soldiers from a hill opposite. The Israeli Defense Forces issued a statement on the day of the incident claiming they had used rubber-coated metal bullets, not live ammunition, during the protests. But a forensic report, with evidence published by British experts Forensic Architecture, has challenged the IDF's claim. The report states, quote, "Contrary to repeated claims of Israeli officials, the available medical and image evidence, as well as witness testimony, strongly suggests Abid el-Rahman's injuries were caused by live ammunition," unquote. Director of the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission of the Northern West Bank, Murad Shitewi, also a coordinator of nonviolent resistance marches in Kafir Kadum, said, quote, "Protesters didn't shoot anything except live videos documenting sounds of fire," unquote. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights is reporting that 95 Palestinian civilians, including 43 children, a woman, two paramedics, and a journalist, were shot and injured by Israeli occupation forces' fire against peaceful protesters at the 80th Great March of Return on Friday, October 25, 2019. UN expert calls for international ban on Israeli products made in settlements. Haaretz is reporting from October 23, 2019, that Michael Link, the UN expert on human rights in the Palestinian territories, is calling for an international ban on all products made in Israeli settlements as a step to potentially end Israel's 52-year-old, quote, illegal occupation, unquote. Link told the General Assembly's Human Rights Committee Wednesday that the international community should also issue, quote, a clarion call to the United Nations, unquote, to complete and release a database, quote, on businesses engaged in activities related to the illegal settlements, unquote. The Federation of American Scientists has published the Congressional Research Service report, Israel, Background in U.S. Relations in Brief, updated late September. At intrepidreport.com, Wayne Mattson, on October 22, 2019, once again the U.S. Congressional Research Service reported August 7, 2019, that Israel has been the largest recipient of cumulative assistance since World War II. In current non-inflation-adjusted dollars, Israel has received a total of $142.3 billion in U.S. bilateral assistance and defense funding. Most of the U.S. government assistance has been military in nature. In addition to U.S. assistance, Israel bonds sold through the Development Corporation for Israel, DCI, which is headquartered in New York, have seen $40 billion in sales, with $1.2 billion in annual sales being reached in 2013, a record for annual sales. One of the reasons behind the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS program is the fact that 90 U.S. states and municipalities, in addition to labor unions, corporations, universities, and foundations, have invested their pensions and treasury funds in the Development Corporation for Israel. The Middle East Monitor reports from October 30, 2019, that Sweden's new foreign minister, Ann Linde, said that the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, is not anti-Semitic. In an interview with Swedish television, Lind asserted that, quote, "Boycotts are a legitimate political means as part of a nonviolent political struggle for human rights, democracy, freedom of expression, and ending the occupation," unquote. On September 5, 2019, the Jerusalem Post reported that Kentucky had become the 26th U.S. state to pass an anti-BDS law. The anti-BDS law reflected official opposition by the Commonwealth of Kentucky and Governor Bevins to doing business with significant contractors who participate in boycotts of the State of Israel. Jewish organizations in Kentucky, such as Jewish Community Relations Council and the Jewish Community of Louisville, claim calls to boycott Israel are mildly veiled anti-Semitism. Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations Chairman Arthur Stark and CEO Malcolm Hohenlein praised the signing of Senate Bill 143, saying, quote, "Kentucky is the 26th state to enact legislation combating the viciously anti-Semitic Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions BDS campaign. We look forward to the remaining 24 states rejecting the pernicious BDS campaign in the days ahead, unquote. Burning trees and beating farmers, Israeli settlers wreak havoc on another olive harvest at mondawais.net, October 21st, 2019. Every year without fail, Palestinians mark the beginning of autumn with the olive harvest, a sacred cultural event. Families from across the country leave their towns and head for the olive groves passed down to them from the generations before. Every year without fail, much of the harvest is also characterized by attacks on Palestinian farmers and families by Israeli settlers and armed soldiers. Since the harvest began in early October, several incidents of settler attacks on farmers and their crops have been reported by activists and organizations in the occupied West Bank. The UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reported more than 10 settler attacks directly related to the olive harvest in the first 2 weeks of the month. Olive oil waste recycled as energy source in Gaza, Xinhuanet.com reports on October 22, 2019. Engineers from the southern Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis have recently succeeded to turn olive oil waste into flammable and eco-friendly pumice wood that can be used to heat houses during winter. WhatsApp has sued Israeli surveillance firm NSO Group, Reuters reports from October 29, 2019, accusing it of helping government spies in a hacking spree whose targets included diplomats, political dissidents, journalists, and senior government officials. WhatsApp said in a statement that 100 civil society members had been targeted and called it, quote, an unmistakable pattern of abuse, unquote. NSO denied the allegations. India Today reported on November 4, 2019, that the Northern District Court of California had issued warrants against two Israeli cyber intelligence companies, NSO Group Technologies and Q Cyber Technologies, in the WhatsApp civil suit about the Israeli intelligence-created Pegasus malware sent to approximately 1,400 mobile phones on four continents. Now to Margo Patterson's interview with Allison Weir.
This is Margo Patterson with the Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel and Palestine. The Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories is now in its 52nd year. Americans are used to reading and hearing the word occupation, but a great many Americans have only a vague sense of what the occupation entails or how it is experienced. Here to talk to us about the Israeli occupation is Allison Weir, an American journalist who visited the Palestinian territories 18 years ago, an experience that led her to found the nonprofit organization If Americans Knew, which reports on the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Allison is a narrator of an award-winning 2006 documentary film, Occupation 101, directed by the brothers Abdullah and Sufyan Omesh, which features Palestinian, Israeli, and American lawyers, journalists, human rights activists, religious authorities, diplomats, and NGO representatives talking about the occupation and its repercussions. Allison Weir, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Allison, let's start off talking about your first trip to Israel and Palestine and your first exposure to the occupation. How did that trip come about? Where did you go, and what did you learn from being over there?
Well, that was resulted from just curiosity. In the fall of 2000, I was the editor of a small, very local newspaper in Northern California, not covering international news, really not even covering national news. But I got curious about the uprising that had started in that fall in the Palestinian territories. So just out of curiosity, I decided to follow the news coverage on it. And as a journalist, I studied journalism, I noticed very quickly that the coverage was very one-sided, that we were hearing from and about Israelis in great detail, as I wanted, but we were almost never hearing from and about Palestinians. You know, this is I knew this was a conflict between two populations, two parties, but we were mostly hearing from one of them. So the internet had just become available to people like me, and I decided to try to look into it for myself, discovered a number of good sources of information right from the region itself, humanitarian agencies, Israeli media, Palestinian media, and I quickly learned that there was enormous violence being committed against Palestinians, largely unarmed, Palestinians, men, women, and children. And it was far more violent. Many children were being killed and maimed back in fall of 2000. So I got drawn in more and more, and it seemed to me after a while that it seemed to me the most covered up issue I had ever seen. And I've seen many in my life. But this one seemed to have lasted longer, spanned the political spectrum. Both liberal and conservative media, it appeared to me, were just not telling us what was going on. So I finally decided to quit my job in Sausalito, California, and travel over to the West Bank and Gaza as a freelance reporter in February and March of 2001, before 9/11, by a number of months. And I did see enormous devastation in the occupied territories, in Gaza and the West Bank. I saw entire neighborhoods that were bullet-riddled, you know, large homes holding a number of extended families were in ruins. I saw many children who had been shot by Israeli forces. The hospitals had many children that had been shot often in the back. They were running away from Israeli soldiers, sometimes in the head, sometimes, you know, in the stomach. As I traveled around there, it was really extremely intense and extremely sad to see, of course. I think what was going on there was really far worse than people were realizing back in the United States. It was Israeli forces were extremely violent. I was going to areas that were being shelled by Israeli forces every night. Helicopter gunships were there. I remember one part in Gaza, looking around and thinking that it looked like photographs I had seen of World War II devastation. And what occurred to me is that this was a war that was going on, but the Palestinians had, at that time, they weren't even launching any rockets yet. I was there before a single rocket. Continually tell Americans that Israel's defending itself from rockets. This was before any rocket.
Well, let me jump in here and ask you a little bit more about Gaza in 2001 when you went over there. Was there a great difference, did you find then, in conditions in Gaza versus the occupied West Bank? Or were both territories being treated about the same by Israeli forces?
Well, the West Bank was also being shelled. So I remember going around there, and it was also being shelled. There were Israeli forces invading villages and towns. You couldn't then and still can't now often get from one village to the next village in the West Bank itself, because there are Israeli military checkpoints with Israeli soldiers holding machine guns in between. So it was very bad in the West Bank. But it was, as I recall, it was worse in Gaza. Gaza was more isolated. It was difficult even then to get into. The first time I tried to go to Gaza, soldiers wouldn't let me in. I think Americans don't realize that these territories are basically prisons, because a prison consists of an area where someone else controls whether you get in or out. And in the case of Gaza and in the case of the West Bank, Israel determines whether you get in and out. So I was able to get into the West Bank. It wasn't always easy to get to different parts of it, but it was possible. But Gaza, sometimes even then, the first time I tried to go, I couldn't get in. But then I did try again later, and I did get in. So it was more isolated. I think the devastation was greater than I had seen in the West Bank at that time, although later there was equal devastation against Jenin and against Nablus. But Gaza, I think, was especially cut off and was especially enduring more massive shelling at that time. I think there was more destruction, very visible destructions of entire homes being destroyed, entire, as I said, entire neighborhoods, entire blocks of family homes were in ruins, And again, this is just, you know, wasn't being shown to Americans. I used to listen to NPR all the time, to Linda Gradstein, who I now know. Her children are Israelis. Her husband, I believe, had been in the Israeli military. So at that time, I hadn't yet realized how biased a journalist it was. But when I went there and saw for myself, it was far worse than any hints that I've been getting from NPR, from the New York Times, from the San Francisco Chronicle.
And I'm just going to jump in here for those listeners who might not be familiar with Nablus and Jenin. Those are two cities in the West Bank. Allison, the stated aim of your organization, If Americans Knew, is to tell every American, quote, what they need to know about Israel-Palestine. What do they need to know about the occupation specifically?
Well, so many things. I'd like to emphasize, we're nonpartisan. We don't, you know, try to target just liberals or just conservatives. We don't blame one side or the other. We just try to give everybody we possibly can the facts on this issue. In terms of the occupation, first of all, I guess it's very important that we all know that our tax money is being used by Israel in what it does, that Americans give Israel over $10 million per day. That's per day. That is far more than we have given to other countries. In fact, on average, we give Israelis per capita about 7,000 times more money than we give to other people around the world. So we, as Americans, because of our governmental actions, are very connected to this issue. And most of us don't know that. We think of it as far away, confusing, and basically have nothing to do with us. So I think that's the first thing that I think Americans have the right and the need to know. Secondly, in terms of the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza, these are occupied territories. Israel has military control over both of them. The West Bank is very officially occupied territory. Gaza, although Israeli settlements were removed a number of years ago, is still under the military control, as Amnesty International and a number of other organizations have specifically stated. It's still under the military control of Israel. It's also important for people to know that the occupation is illegal. This is violates international law, that the creation of settlements in the West Bank, let's look at what settlements are. Sometimes, you know, people will read about settlements. There's really never an explanation of what they are. What they are is the Israeli government confiscating Palestinian land, taking it over for Jewish-only land. It's not Israeli-only land because the almost 20% of the Israeli population are Palestinians. They're not allowed to live in those settlements. But somebody from Brooklyn, who's of the Jewish ethnicity, can come and get a subsidized license in these settlements. Under international law, the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 49 makes it illegal for the occupying power to deport or transfer part of its own civilian population into an area. So these settlements are illegal. And every time there's a news report about settlements, that should be part of the context that is reported, and yet it virtually never is.
This is Margot Patterson with the Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm talking today to Allison Weir, a journalist who founded If Americans Knew. Allison, the website of If Americans Knew is very comprehensive. It keeps a running tally of the number of dead and injured on both sides. It offers a history of the conflict as well as information on the current situation. It provides data on Palestinian prisoners, home demolitions, and settlements. I want to ask you all about all three of those last items because they all underpin the occupation. I see that according to your website today, 6,279 Palestinians are being held prisoner by Israeli authorities. Zero Israelis are imprisoned. I was surprised to learn when I interviewed longtime Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi a few years ago that probably 800,000 to a million Palestinians had been imprisoned at some point or other since the occupation began. talk to us about the rights of Palestinians living under military occupation and the situation of Palestinian prisoners.
They have almost no rights. Under international law, of course, they're supposed to have many rights. The occupying power of the military is actually supposed to look out for the safety and best interests of those under its occupation. The U.S., of course, occupied Japan for a period of time. We didn't take over the land, and we didn't, you know, form American colonies there, but that's what Israel is doing. So what Israel does, and anybody that looks at the news reports from Palestinian media, you'll see that every day Israeli soldiers come into the West Bank, grab a bunch of people, usually at least a dozen, from various villages and towns, and imprison them for varying periods of time. This is done with impunity. They have something called administrative detention, which is a fancy word for holding somebody without charge and without trial for endless periods of time. Now, supposedly, you know, the Israeli talking point here is, oh, that's only for 6 months. For 6 months, they can hold someone without charging them and with even charging them with a crime. But it's not just 6 months. This can be renewed and often is renewed endlessly. So people are often held many years, without even being charged with a crime, no evidence that they've committed a crime. And this goes on all the time against men, women, and minors. The conditions in the prisons are often horrific. People are beaten, deprived of sufficient and, you know, healthy food, etc. The Red Cross can and does visit them sometimes, but the Red Cross often does not tell what they see in the prisons because, and I've communicated to the Red Cross about the fact that they don't tell people about the conditions within the prisons most often. And the reason they don't is because if they did that, Israel wouldn't let them visit any longer. So at least they're able to get in there and try to do something. But Israel holds the power. So if the Red Cross people started telling the world what's going on in the prison, Israel just wouldn't let them come in anymore. You know, the Israeli power over the narrative is profound. Fortunately, however, there are a number of organizations that are getting this information out. It's almost never in the U.S. media, but there are Palestinian organizations that are documenting it very thoroughly. There are Israeli organizations. There's an Israeli group called the Israelis Against Torture that are documenting what's going on. There was a report, actually, in the Foreign Service Journal a number of years ago. This is one of the few places where it did get into somewhat mainstream media, though, of course, the average person doesn't read Foreign Service Journal. That article documented the torture of American citizens that were being by Israeli forces in Israeli prisons. These were Americans that were Palestinian Americans that were being tortured by Israel. The article was in Foreign Service Journal, and yet almost nobody knows about it. And Foreign Service Journal, although it was in their print publication, did not put it on its website.
Well, let me ask you another question here. You mentioned settlements. Since 1967, when the Israeli occupation began, every Israeli government has established Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. What is Israel's rationale for building these settlements? Is it just a naked land grab, or is there some defensive purpose, as Israel once claimed?
That's a very good question. Mainly they just say we have the right to do it. They just, you know, don't defend why they're doing it very often, other than they just want that land. There's a portion of the Israeli public, a fairly large portion, it's not the majority, but a large portion, who just believe all of the land belongs to Israel, including much more than the current borders of Israel. One of the things Americans should know is that Israel, that's often called the only democracy in the Middle East, has never set its borders intentionally because it was planning to expand them, as it continues to do. So we don't really know what Israel's borders are. And it, by the way, it also never adopted a constitution for very significant reasons. So basically, Israel, from the beginning, has expanded its control of the land and continually has taken more and more of the land. And much of this is to create these settlements that are going on in the West Bank. It's interesting to see where they're located, because often they're located in certain areas, with the result in the more that they are put there, they divide up the West Bank into three pieces increasingly, so it becomes less and less contiguous. It's more and more difficult when you're in the West Bank to go to different areas, because there are all these Israeli settlements and Israeli checkpoints blocking the way. They often seem to be associated with the aquifer, the Palestinian aquifer, and confiscating more and more of the water that's under the territory's land that by rights should belong to the people living on that land. But much of that aquifer is being taken to go to Israeli settlements, and that some of it goes to Israel itself. When you're in the occupied territories, often water is very scarce. You know, people are restricted to the number of gallons of water they're able to get every day. Often it runs out and you can only have water for bathing infrequently. You have to sort of ration the water because so much of it. And yet in the West Bank, in the settlements, you'll see green grass, that they're using the water to water their grass, while Palestinians nearby barely have enough drinking water.
During the Trump administration, there's been a significant increase in settlement expansion and construction. Tell us what that means for any prospect for a two-state solution. Is a two-state solution still viable given this expansion of settlements?
Not unless it withdrew those settlements, because right now there are so many settlements, so much of the land has been confiscated, that if you look at a map, what would have been the Palestinian state under the so-called two-state solution is riddled with Israeli settlements in the Middle East. So they're just little pieces of land that would supposedly be a Palestinian state. Of course, that's impossible. It would have no sovereignty. It would not give a viable state. So what's been happening under the Trump administration, but also happened under Barack Obama, also happened under Bill Clinton, is the continual confiscation of Palestinian land being taken over for Jewish-only settlements.
Allison, we have just a very limited amount of time left. I'm going to try to squeeze in two questions. The first, talk to us, if you will, about home demolitions. How does that play into the occupation and expanding control of the Palestinian territories?
That's such an important question to discuss. Israeli forces have demolished, I think it's over 10,000 Palestinian homes. And that's the number for a long time, so clearly it's higher than that. They just demolished them yesterday. In fact, there's a video of it online. Israel at will, I think people need to understand what it's like to live in the occupied territories. You really have no power to protect your children, to protect your property, to live a normal life. Of course, there are real attempts to live normal lives. People get married and have celebrations and have parties and et cetera. But it's always under the control of whether Israel lets you do that or not. So in a number of cases, Israel decides to confiscate some Palestinian land, either because they're thickening or enlarging a settlement. They're supposedly not creating a new one. They're just enlarging one, which means, your home is too close. They destroy your home. The demolition that occurred yesterday was because it was supposedly too close to the American embassy, so they destroy the person's home. Sometimes they do say that they are demolishing the homes for security purposes, because they're constantly enlarging the so-called security zone that they need next to the wall that's imprisoning Palestinians. By the way, the Israeli wall that we sometimes hear about, the separation wall or whatever it's called, is on Palestinian land. It's confiscating Palestinian land. But then they confiscate even more land because they say, oh, there needs to be a security barrier that gets wider and wider and larger and larger. And, oh, dear, your home is in what we have now declared a security zone, so your home is demolished.
Well, last question.
People's homes are suddenly gone.
Last question for you, Allison. Right now, the country is very preoccupied with this issue of whether President Trump misused his power as president, injecting politics into foreign policy with regards to Ukraine. I think you maintain that U.S. foreign policy with regards to Israel-Palestine is all about politics. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. See, the fact is, and remember, I've been working on this issue now for 18 years. This is my full-time position. I study it. I research it. I've written a book on it. I've interviewed numerous numbers of people. I've gone to the region a number of times. The fact is, it's very clear, those of us that have worked on this issue, it's very clear that the Israel lobby, the lobby in the United States on behalf of Israel, is driving our policies. Israel is clearly interfering in our elections. Netanyahu, you know, played a number, certainly has been very partisan in the way he's approached things. So the fact is that the Israel lobby, and the Israel lobby is massive. It's on our website, we have a list of the Israel lobby, of all the organizations in the United States that work directly and openly for Israel as their primary agenda, and all the additional organizations that do it as one of their missions. You know, they'll list the number of missions, the ADL, the so-called Anti-Defamation League. One of its primary actions it has on its website is advocating for Israel, lobbying the media, the campuses, elected officials. This is all right on the ADL website. So the Israel lobby is very pervasive. The Anti-Defamation League itself has a net assets of about $150 million. On top of that, you have Israel partisans in both parties, Haim Saban in the Democratic Party, Sheldon Adelson in the Republican Party, both multi-billionaires who are deploying their money on behalf of Israel.
Allison,
when you look into the Israel lobby, it's a multi-billion dollar lobby that's in our country that most of us don't really know about. I never used to know about.
Allison, thank you so very much for talking to us today. I've been talking to Allison Weir, a journalist who covers Israel and Palestine, and she is the founder of the website and organization If Americans Knew, which will tell you anything and everything you ever wanted to know about the conflict. Allison, you might just want to give the website to us.
ifamericansknew.org. ifamericansknew.org.
Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Margot Patterson with Allison Weir, and you've been listening to The Much Too Promised Land, Understanding Israel-Palestine, produced by Citizens for Justice in the Middle East. You're tuned in to KKFI 90.1 Kansas City.